content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first story today, an e-bike transformed my family's life. Getting around on one might be a bit slower than in a car, but it's also so much richer. This is by Elizabeth Endicott. On a chilly morning last October, my 8-year-old daughter and I took our new e-bike, which she had named Toby, on its maiden voyage to school. We admired trees exploding in vibrant golds and flocks of geese soaring above. To amuse ourselves, we brought along a life-size Halloween skeleton, which sat in the back with my daughter, arms outstretched in a friendly wave. Along the way, people honked, smiled, and stopped to chat. I felt connected to our neighborhood in a way I hadn't experienced. Before Toby, mornings spent driving my daughter to school were monotonous and filled with traffic. Since the purchase, our commutes have become daily highlights. My daughter and I bond with each other and our community. We get to appreciate the time outdoors, all while saving on car maintenance and mitigating our carbon footprint. But the e-bike has changed our life in many other ways, too. Some of them unexpectedly profound. Our family's motivation to get an e-bike started with climate concerns. Kids learn by example, and my husband and I often wondered if we were setting the right one by driving two gas-guzzling cars. But the alternatives were limited. We couldn't afford to purchase an electric vehicle. Electric scooters were out of the question. They're meant to transport only one person and can be dangerous for children. I tried biking to school once, my daughter behind me in a trailer. Many miles later, I showed up drenched in sweat. Great as a workout, but impractical for day to day. So when our city introduced subsidies on e-bikes, we decided to give one a try. They're fairly safe, cheaper than cars, and gentle on the environment. Plus, one study shows they make for some of the happiest commuters. We chose one in a zippy sky blue, with two padded bench seats, metal safety bars, and oversized storage bags on either side. It's cheerful and somehow charismatic, befitting its sweet name. Our first trip that October day, it was clear how much easier and more pleasant getting around on Toby would be than driving in a car. We avoided the worst of the car traffic and all the huffing and puffing of cycling. E-bikes are still great exercise. Riders burn only about 15 to 30% fewer calories on them than people on typical bikes do. But you probably won't get sweaty enough to need a shower. I also felt good knowing that riding Toby enabled us to act more in line with our environmental values. Research from the Rocky Mountain Institute, a nonpartisan nonprofit focused on energy, has found that if all drivers in the 10 most populous American cities switched from cars to e-bikes for trips shorter than 5 miles, a category that makes up more than 60% of all car trips in the United States, the emissions reductions would be equivalent to avoiding the use of 4 natural gas plants over the course of a year. And the costs were affordable for our family. Our e-bike was $1,200 after the subsidy, requires an annual $200 tune-up, and accrues negligible electricity costs. They're a bit pricier without the subsidies. A good one goes for about $2,000, but savings on gas would add up fast. More than the practicality, I've appreciated how much easier Toby has made it to connect with my daughter. Sitting directly behind me, She's more involved in our journey than when she's in the back seat of a car. So opportunities for learning come naturally. I alert her to upcoming bumps, narrate various turns and stops, and ask her to double-check for cars coming up behind us. We've discussed the satisfaction of using our bodies to get somewhere, rather than letting the throttle do all the work. Toby can go up to 25 miles an hour, so I've explained the importance of slowing down for pedestrians. Being out in the open air also gives us a chance to stop and say hello to people we recognize and to meet our neighbors, which we rarely did before. We don't belong in siloed cars driving around our neighborhoods. Arlie Greenwald, a bike mechanic and creator of the online community resource Cargo Bike Life, told me in an email, "Whereas cars shut us off from other people, bikes open up opportunities to bond. Riding them is a step toward creating a connected community," Greenwald wrote. Of course, e-bikes aren't for everyone. Families in high-level apartments without elevators would struggle to lug them upstairs. Parking them outside takes some forethought and a good lock. Most batteries last for only about 15 to 60 miles. So the bikes are best for shorter travel. They won't help much with moving either. Toby can handle Costco runs for our family of three, but probably not for a big family. For those who do use an e-bike, getting around can be tricky. Cities weren't built for e-bikes, and Greenwald pointed out some roads aren't safe for them. She recommended testing routes on your own before you bring your kids, asking local bike shops about safe options, and accepting when you'll have to go with another mode of transport. If I'm replacing as many car trips with safe e-bike trips as possible, Greenwald told me, I'm doing great. In our rides, my daughter and I have encountered plenty of those infrastructural hurdles. Some routes don't have bike lanes or have lanes that end at random spots. Others expect us to go upstairs. When this happens, my daughter and I chat about why, and then we contact our local representatives together to request improvements, an important lesson in civic engagement. But once we found our best route to school, these obstacles faded. It takes 5 extra minutes each way, but that time is spent along a river trail where we've spotted herons, kingfishers, and kestrels. Our time outside has otherwise decreased as my daughter has gotten older, so this tether to the outdoors has been a gift. Being in nature can help kids manage stress, grow more self-confident, and maintain their mental health. Pooja Tandon, a pediatrician and researcher at Seattle Children's Research Institute, told me in an email, "I see this in my daughter, who seems cheerful and refreshed most mornings, not half awake like she used to be." No matter how well her day starts, school can still be an interpersonal minefield. When I picked up my daughter in the car, she dealt with the residual stress by communicating through grunts. Now, perhaps energized by our rides, she tells funny or embarrassing tales and updates me on the second grade gossip. I found that challenging conversations are easier on Toby, too. When our cat recently passed away, my daughter waited until our commute to ask hard questions about death. Surrounded by nature and without the pressure of direct eye contact, I was able to think calmly about how to answer her in honest, age-appropriate ways. It's been 5 months since Toby's first journey, and we've ridden nearly 1,000 miles. These days, e-biking feels easier than driving, even in situations you might not expect. We recently biked home after school as dark clouds rolled in over the Rockies and the first snowflakes of a late winter storm feathered the sky. At a red light, we heard my daughter's name and saw her classmates' family in an SUV next to us. They seemed shocked that we were biking in the cold. I might have felt that way once, too, but we were dressed warmly, and we didn't want to give up our ride along the river path. That day we watched waterfall tuck into the river shallows for the evening and stopped to tell a neighbor with a new baby that we'd shovel their driveway in the morning. I worried that my daughter might have felt embarrassed about the stoplight encounter, but as we unbuckled our helmets in our driveway, she said she bet her friend had been wishing he was on an e-bike too. She clearly understood what I'd come to learn about e-bikes. Yes, our commutes were slightly slower and a little bit chillier than they once had been, but they were also so much richer. Our next story from the ideas section is entitled Buy, Borrow, Die: How to Be a Billionaire and Pay No Taxes by Roger Karma. America's super rich have always found ways to avoid paying taxes, but in recent years they've discovered what might be the mother of all loopholes. It's a three-step process called buy, borrow, die, and it allows people to amass a huge fortune, spend as much of it as they want, and pass the rest, untaxed, on to their heirs. The technique is so cleverly designed that the standard wish list of progressive tax reforms would leave it completely intact. Step 1. Buy. The average American derives most of their disposable income from the wages they earn working a job, but the super rich are different. They amass their fortune by buying and owning assets that appreciate. Elon Musk hasn't taken a traditional salary as CEO of Tesla since 2019. Warren Buffett, the chair of Berkshire Hathaway, has famously kept his salary at $100,000 for more than 40 years. Their wealth consists almost entirely of stock in the companies they've built or invested in. The tax law scholars Edward Fox and Zachary Liskow found that even when you exclude the 400 wealthiest individuals in America, the remaining members, of the top 1% hold $23 trillion in assets. Unlike wages, which are taxed at the moment that they are earned, assets are taxed only at the moment they are sold, or in tax terms, realized. The justification for this approach is that unrealized assets exist only on paper. You can't pay for a private jet or buy a company with stocks, even if they have appreciated by billions of dollars. In theory, the rich will eventually need to sell their assets for cash, at which point they will pay taxes on their increase in wealth. That theory would be much closer to reality if not for step two, borrow. Instead of selling their assets to make major purchases, the super rich can use them as collateral to secure loans, which, because they must eventually be repaid, are also not considered taxable income. Larry Ellison, a co-founder of Oracle and America's fourth richest person, has pledged more than $30 billion of his company's stock as collateral in order to fund his lavish lifestyle, which includes building a $270 million yacht, buying a $300 million island, and purchasing an $80 million mansion. A Forbes analysis found that as of April of 2022, Musk had pledged Tesla shares worth more than $94 billion, which serve as an evergreen credit facility, giving Musk access to cash whenever he needs it. This strategy isn't as common among the merely very rich, who may not have the expensive tastes that Ellison and Musk do, but it isn't rare either. Lisco and Fox calculated that the top 1% of wealth holders, excluding the richest 400 Americans, borrowed more than $1 trillion in 2022. And the approach appears to be gaining momentum. Last year, The Economist reported that at Morgan Stanley and Bank of America alone, the value of securities-backed loans increased from $80 billion in 2018 to almost $150 billion in 2022. The real question is, why would you not borrow hundreds of millions, even billions, to fund the lifestyle you want to live? Tom Anderson, a wealth management consultant and former banker who specializes in these loans, told me, "This is such an easy tool to use, and the tax benefits are massive." You might think this couldn't possibly go on forever. Eventually, the rich will need to sell off some of the assets to pay back the loan. That brings us to step three, die. According to the A provision of the tax code, known as stepped-up basis, or more evocatively, the angel of death loophole, when an individual dies, the value that their assets gained during their lifetime becomes immune to taxation. Those assets can then be sold by the billionaire's heirs to pay off any outstanding loans without them having to worry about taxes. The justification for the stepped-up basis rule is that the United States already levies a 40% inheritance tax on fortunes larger than $14 million. And it would be unfair to tax assets twice. In practice, however, a seemingly infinite number of loopholes allow the rich to avoid paying this tax, many of which involve placing assets in Byzantine legal trusts that enable them to be passed seamlessly from one generation to the next. Only morons pay the estate tax, Gary Kahn, a former Goldman Sachs executive, and then chief economic advisor to Donald Trump, memorably remarked in 2017. All of this is completely, perfectly legal, Edward McCaffrey, the scholar who coined the term buy, borrow, die, told me. But he said the strategy has basically killed the entire concept of an income tax for the wealthiest individuals. The tax economist Daniel Reck, who has spent his career documenting the various ways the rich evade taxation, told me that buy, borrow, die is the most important tax avoidance strategy today. The result is a two-tiered tax system, one for the many who earn their income through wages and pay taxes, and another for the few who accumulate wealth through paper assets and largely do not pay taxes. Much of the debate around American tax policy focuses on the income tax rate paid by the very wealthiest Americans, but the bulk of those people's fortunes doesn't qualify as income in the first place. A 2021 ProPublica investigation of the private tax records of America's 25 richest individuals found that they collectively paid an effective tax rate of just 3.4% on their total wealth gain from 2014 to 2018. Musk paid 3.3%, Jeff Bezos 1%, and Buffett, who has famously argued for imposing higher income tax rates on the super rich, just 0.1%. The same dynamic exists in slightly less egregious form further down the wealth distribution. A 2021 White House study found that the 400 richest American households paid an effective tax rate of 6.2% on their total wealth gains from 2010 to 2018. Lisko and Fox found that, excluding the top 400, the rest of the 0.1% richest individuals paid an effective tax rate of 12% from 2004 to 2022. 12% is the income tax rate paid by individuals who make $11,600 to $47,150 a year. One solution to this basic unfairness would be to tax unrealized assets. In 2022, the Biden administration proposed a, quote, billionaire minimum tax, end quote, that would have placed a new annual levy of up to 20% on the appreciation of even unsold assets for households with more than $100 million in wealth. Experts have vehemently debated the substantive merits of such a policy. The real problem, however, is political. According to a survey conducted by Liskow and Fox, most Americans oppose a tax on unrealized gains, even when applied only to the richest individuals. The Joe Biden proposal, perhaps unsurprisingly, went nowhere in Congress. Making matters more complicated, even if such a policy did pass, the Supreme Court would very likely rule it unconstitutional. The second idea would be to address the borrow step. Last year, Lisko and Fox published a proposal to tax the borrowing of households worth more than $100 million, which they estimated would raise about $10 billion a year. The limitation of that solution, as the authors acknowledge, is that it would not address the larger pool of rich Americans who don't borrow heavily against their assets, but do take advantage of the stepped-up basis. That leaves the die step. Tax experts from across the political spectrum generally support eliminating the stepped-up basis rule, allowing unrealized assets to be taxed at death. This would be far more politically palatable than the dead-on-arrival billionaire's minimum tax. The same survey in which respondents overwhelmingly opposed broad taxes on unrealized assets during life, Lisko and Fox, also found that nearly two-thirds of them supported taxing unrealized assets at death. Even a change this widely supported, however, would run up against the iron law of democratic politics. Policies with concentrated benefits and distributed costs are very hard to overturn. That's especially true when the benefits just so happen to be concentrated among the richest, most powerful people in the country. In fact, the Biden administration did propose eliminating stepped-up basis as part of its Build Back Better legislation. The move prompted an intense backlash from special interest groups and their allied politicians, with opponents portraying the provision as an assault on rural America that would destroy family farms and businesses. These claims were completely unfounded. The bill had specific exemptions for family businesses and applied only to assets greater than $2.5 million. But the effort succeeded at riling up enough Democratic opposition to kill the idea. One guarantee of any tax regime is that eventually the rich and powerful will learn how to game it. In theory, a democratic system operating on behalf of the majority should be able to respond by making adjustments that force the rich to pay their fair share. But in a world where money readily translates to political power, voice, and influence, the super-rich have virtually endless resources at their disposal to make sure that doesn't happen. To make society more equal, you need to tax the rich, but to tax the rich. It helps for society to be more equal. Now for a Dear James column. Dear James, I miss being on dating apps. I've hit the relationship jackpot, but now I have romance fear of missing out. By James Parker. Dear James, I'm a man in a relationship with a woman I met on Hinge a little over a year ago. We're both in our early 30s, and things have been absolutely great. I love her. My friends and family all love her. We're planning to move in together later this year, and ideally, this all ends in happily ever after, with marriage and a kid or two. By all accounts, I've won the game of ring toss, that is online dating. And yet, part of me misses playing the game. Throw a rock online and you'll hit some article about everyone being fed up with and burned out by dating apps. But I feel bittersweet about the fact that my days on the apps are presumably over. I saw every match and first date I went on as a symbol of hope and possibility. Of course, I experienced disappointments, and yeah, I was ghosted lots of times, but I had plenty of good times, too. Through dating apps, I met brilliant, hilarious, beautiful, and incredibly kind women with whom I enjoyed stimulating conversations and intimate moments of multiple varieties, and I'm a little melancholic at the thought that I won't experience any of that again. Are these the normal things to think about at this point in a serious relationship? I'm a bit of an anxious person. This discomfort definitely seems like something an anxious person would feel in the face of an impending major life event. But is there a point where this nostalgia for the apps stops being something I'll get over and become something I need to address? Dear reader, sex, sex, sex. Here's what I think about that. Two important things about sex must be clearly and constantly stated. One, it's the greatest thing in the world. Two, it's quite overrated. Under current conditions, the laws of time and space, etc., choosing a partner means unchoosing all the other partners. It's not a brilliant system, but it's what we have. Either you whirl around incontinently, intimate moments of multiple varieties a go-go, or you pledge your genitals to one person and settle down to await whatever happens next. Eros, the uncontrollable spirit, the force that through the green fuse drives the flower, is mounting a bit of an assault on your imagination right now. This is completely normal. It's not going to stop either. Eros hates domesticity. Eros hates a sensible choice. Eros even hates the right choice, which is twisted. But there we are. Don't worry about your happily ever after just yet, one thing at a time. Move in together, see how it feels. You don't have to act on or indulge every flutter of your dreaming libido. At that point, it'll be time for a rethink. On your team, James. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.